This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Blauergeist. We're just going to be discussing art, architecture, interior design, film 2. And Blauergeist, he mostly posts on Twitter, different like aesthetic imagery. Blauergeist, great having you on, and also joined here with Matt Pegan.
Thank you. Glad to be on, guys.
Yeah, likewise. Glad to co-host. I've heard Blauergeist on the Perfume Nationalist several different episodes, so good to have him on this podcast.
Rock and roll.
So do you have a background in arts, architecture, or interior design? And can you kind of give like a brief introduction to yourself?
Yeah, I don't really have any formal background in, like, I guess, aesthetics, anything like architecture or interior design or anything like that. I graduated with a major in journalism, and I had always been into, I guess, the aesthetic kind of stuff. Like, I liked, like, I preferred taking, like, the art history classes and, like, design classes like that, but I never had, like, a sort of academic concentration in it. And then I would say, I think Instagram has been really good to sort of like inculcate a kind of aesthetic appreciation nowadays, because you have so, and like, this is where I get all of my content from. Like, you have so many accounts like this Nexus of like, or not Nexus, constellation of like old, like vintage and like retro interiors, and like, whether it's like 50s to like even 90s now. It's funny that people are being nostalgic for like 90s and 2000s interior design, which is a trip. But yeah, and so just sort of hanging out on Instagram, sort of naturally gravitated to kind of a maximalist kind of thing. Like, I guess my most controversial trad take is that carpeting in bathrooms is good.
I think you brought this up on Jack's show, the Perfume Nationalist, but what if you have, like, a guest over who's a bit messy?
Then we'll cross that bridge when you get there. But yeah, I mean, I've always felt it's sort of like the whole carpeting and bathrooms thing, it's just sort of people telling on themselves. And there is actually a problem now in, like, modern interior design, and especially because so many people live in apartments these days, and I live in an apartment too, that like every sort of bathroom is like an interior room, so there's really no window to like let it like ventilate and stuff like that. And so because we have this perception of the bathroom as like this interior space, we don't let our sort of imaginations take the step of imagining.
Oh yeah, I mean, most usually a bathroom is totally utilitarian. But yeah, the thing exactly. is, like, your images, they do like bring back kind of hypnagogic memories of maybe being a kid and visiting like some wealthy household and visiting their bathroom.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also like lots of brick glass.
Oh yeah, I love the glass brick. yeah, that's always been a sort of focal point of mine. Carpeting and bathrooms and glass brick walls. And I like a good, I've lately found myself gravitating towards a lot of like plant life, like a kind of like neo greenhouse kind of aesthetic is pretty cool too.
Fake oh yeah, like plant and greenhouse aesthetic. And Brick Glass is, like, I do remember it used to be a lot of restaurants in L.A. had it and a lot of offices, but a lot of it, yeah, like, all these different renovations. But I'm sure, like, Matt, you're in L.A., like, how common is it still, Brick Glass?
Brick Glass, not that common. I have the sense that people demolish it where they can. I associate it pretty strong with the 80s, and I think a lot of other people, you know, would think of it as having that look too. So I think it's the kind of thing that ends up getting destroyed. However, you do see it sometimes, but I always note it when I see it, and I too am a fan, so I always.
I'm thinking of for LA listeners, this restaurant in Beverly Hills. I used to. It was a kind of southwestern kind of Tex-Mex type restaurant. I as like a teenager is where I would go for my birthdays, but it was renovated. It was turned in. It shut down maybe about like 3 to 4 years ago, about 4 years ago. But yeah, they did have this kind of, it was like a southwestern motif with like in Beverly Hills, El Torrio. It was off Wilshire, like a southwestern motif, lots of brick glass, and then like the ceiling was painted to look like a sky.
Nice.
I'm actually not familiar with that. I'll have to find some old pictures.
Or yeah, I think so. Yeah, maybe southwestern motif must have been a fad. I'm not really sure when it. I think it may have been. I'm really sure when that restaurant opened. Maybe the late 80s. But yeah, I'm sure even like brick. Yeah, brick glass is harder to find now. And all these kind of renovations. A Blauergeist, do you just kind of post the images casually, or do you document them, or do you plan on documenting them in an archive? As some of them are from Instagram sites which do that, but have you thought about documenting them all? Because the thing is, like, it's kind of hard to, like, if you see an image on your Twitter feed from a few months ago, then maybe you lose track of it. Like, have you thought about documenting them in an archive?
I haven't thought about that. That might be a good idea. I mostly just whatever sort of strikes, like I have like a file in like Instagram, like you can save the photos. And then I'll go back, like if I'm on a tear for like some certain style, I will post a few in a row, but mainly there's really no rhyme or reason to it. It's just sort of whatever is hitting that chord at the moment.
You post images of different architectural genres, interior design, mostly 20th century genres, ranging from the 50s to the 90s. Do you have a favorite genre?
I have a soft spot for like the Memphis style, because that's like so kitschy and like so.
Oh yeah.
Like, weird looking. I also really like the kind of
Memphis.
Like,
it reminds me of a bit of like a Pee-wee's
Playhouse.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like Fisher Price kind of aesthetic. So I've always liked that. I also really like the kind of like 60s to 70s kind of late. Like I don't know the technical schools. Like I said, I don't have like any like formal schooling in this, but like the kind of 60s and 70s mid-century modern that like has like a lot of wood and like I just imagine like sort of like the copper and shag carpet and like a cool fireplace kind of thing.
Oh like, yeah, like a lot of that kind of like, is it, I'm not sure if it's like real stone or fake stone, but around the fireplace, like mid-century modern design, like the like Danish design. And then also American design, like the mid-century space age aesthetic. And I think the designer you posted, Arthur Elrod.
Great.
Yeah, he's great. But I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that mid-century modern is minimalism, because it is very, it's rich in colors and shapes and texture. And I guess one example is like the Madonna Inn in California. That's like peak maximalism, but I'm not really sure like why. That, I mean, that's a misconception that it's always linked to minimalism. There's probably some minimalism, but that's not the overall picture.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, especially when compared to today. I mean, I don't have any formal training in and aesthetics or architecture either, so I'm not sure if my history is off base here, but I could imagine how, you know, compared to the things that preceded mid-century modern, it may have had some minimalist aspects, but compared to contemporary stuff, it's anything but minimalist.
Yeah, well, Art Deco was that was pretty maximalistic, and then from there, Streamline Modern was a bit more towards the direction of minimalism. So maybe in comparison to some past genres, I mean, going way back, like Baroque would have been peak maximalism. The peak of minimalism is basically the present or the 2010s. Or 21st century in general is the peak in minimalism.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of this, like, kind of Scandinavian, faux Japanese kind of, not kitsch exactly, but it's like the, what you see at, like, IKEA and, like, Muji and stuff like that, where it's, like, minimalism. Like, I think minimalism is cool in, like, some circumstances, but, like, the minimalism that we see today is, like, a result of, like, wanting to, like, lower prices and just have, like, big factory mass-produced, like, cabinets and stuff like that. Like, it's not, like, an actual sort of, like, conscious aesthetic. It's just, like, a way to, like, keep, you know, costs down and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, like, Japanese or Scandinavian, you mean from the 21st century because,
yeah,
like, Scandinavia had mid-century modern design, which was excellent, and then Japan, their design probably peaked in the 80s. I'm just thinking of just how minimalism was really embraced, but it was the kind of minimalism of the 2010s especially.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, yeah, you did have like all these 80s malls went for these minimalistic renovations like starting around 2000 and just being kind of replaced by these overall Van L interiors. There's maybe probably a few that might be intact, but for the most part, these 80s malls were pretty much, I mean, malls are closing in general because of the economic situation, but prior to that, most of the ones that are successful have been renovated that are economically viable. And yeah, some of these Instagram accounts that do document the different 80s malls and have images of the past. I mean, Matt and I sort of did that. We got started on this documentary series. Like we did some of the malls in LA. Yeah, they had some pretty amazing aesthetics, and most of them are gone.
Yeah, sidebar there. We never finished this documentary project, but in particular, we toured the West Side Pavilion, which has literally been demolished in the short time since we did that.
When we documented it, it was before the demolition, but it was already transformed by the 2000 renovation.
Yeah, and then you also have, like, sort of a trend of, like, and I guess in a way it's a bit of, like, oh, quote, return to tradition or whatever, where, like, you have these, like, sort of outdoor malls where they're just, like, sort of, like, we have, like, a few of them here, like, sort of in the Portland area that basically are essentially malls, but, like, there's not, like, an interior space. It's all just, like, outside.
Yeah, I don't really get this this sort of the opposition to the malls back in the 80s and 90s was that it was bad for street life. I think interior urbanism has a lot of value, and malls are an example of interior urbanism, and you kind of see it in like you see it in Vegas, and it's popular in Asia as well, but I think it has a lot of value. I think the obsession with everything being on street level is really, it's idiotic, and there's more of a sense of exploration. I'd prefer to see a lot more interior urbanism, but malls were an example of that, and that's kind of died out of popularity.
Yeah, for sure. Well, because you have this sense of like going to like the mall, like this big interior space, interior urbanism, as you say. It's like this: you're entering like a different space from just like, oh, you're walking on like a street and the street is just like has like stores to it. Like when you're entering a mall, you're entering sort of a whole, like almost like a citadel of capital, if you want to like get sort of grandiose about it, that it's like this sort of like castle like environment that like is sort of like completely separate from like the surroundings that are around it.
Yeah, like a sense of place, because
yeah, exactly.
I think like some like there are these sort of urban neighborhoods that are very, very distinct, have distinct identities. They could be historic, but I think most like your average street is just so banal and outright like boring. And but then you enter a mall, like a mall could be just about anywhere, and then you enter this other aura.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, with these minimalist renovations, they don't really have any connection to a past genre. It kind of gets to retrofuturism, but 80s malls often would borrow from past aesthetics, like a Victorian-era shopping arcade.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, there's that meme of Breezewood. Trad Twitter really freaking out about Breezewood. And then there's also that mall, I think it's in South Africa, that you were posting, and Trad Twitter picked up on it as like a bad thing. The one, it's like lots of, I'm not sure. I think it was built around 2000, but it looks actually pretty 80s postmodernism. I forget the name of it.
I love that. It's like Cape Walk or Town Walk or like something Walk. But yeah, I love that space because it is like a mix of like ultra modern.
Okay,
like
yeah. It's called Canal Walk Mall.
Yeah. I love that space because it has like a mix of ultra modern, like you have that like big like Blade Runner style like LCD screen, and like it's just like bursting with like storefronts and like logos and everything. But like if you like notice that like it all has like also like a sort of like wrought iron kind of aesthetic.
Oh yeah. So there's a main atrium with lots of colorful like LED signage.
Yeah.
And that's like where the food court is, and that reminds me of a lot of the older kind of 80s malls. And then it also has a bit of a Vegas feel, like there's it looks like a kind of inspiration of those kind of older like Victorian era
arcade
atriums,
like, yeah.
And then lots of like wrought iron. It looks really cool.
Yeah. But yeah, the whole sort of like the moral panic or aesthetic panic over Breezewood, I think, is very stupid. One, because I think, from what I understand, that's sort of a bit of a forced perspective of that photo. Like, it's not all bunched up together like that as much as, like, it suggests. Like, it is a bit of, like, it's a bit more spread out than it suggests. And also, I mean, if you're on a long road trip and you come upon Breezewood, you're not going to be like, oh my God, this is just American capital excess. It's horrible and unaesthetic. You're going to be like, oh, thank God I can finally get like a fucking burger and fill my gas tank and stuff like that.
I mean, there is a kind of aesthetic appeal to kind of that roadside architecture. I mean, obviously there's the more kind of vintage, like mid-century roadside architecture design. But also if you're kind of on a road trip, especially at night, on the highway, and then you see kind of, even if it's like fast food, I don't totally hate it.
Yeah. It's easy to knock on modernity or whatever when you're in the comfort of like your, you know, the house at your parents' place, you know, but once you're actually out there, you know, sometimes it's convenient.
I mean, there's a lot of these different kind of retrofuturistic genres. Is that an interest of yours?
A little bit. Well, tell me more.
Well, there's retrofuturistic as these kind of conceptual illustrations of how the past envisioned the future, and then, oh yeah, a lot of these images that you post just capture that as well.
Oh, yeah. I do, like, yeah, I find it fascinating. It's like when you see, like, illustrations of like 19, even as like late as like the 60s, 1960 imagines what the year 2000 will be like, and like it's funny because it's like they get close to how it actually is, but like they don't have this sort of like they lack the certain connected, like it's true that we like you'll see like some like illustration of like a businessman, you know, classic man in gray flannel suit, like he's like looking at his like TV that's on his wrist, and even though it's not exactly looking like that today, essentially they got it correct. We do basically have full entertainment systems, you know, on our persons at all times.
Yeah, I'd say like the technological aspects, I think even like Back to the Future communicating, like how in Back to the Future they would depict them communicating with each other by a video screen, and that's basically the technology we have now. I think the technological aspects, that was predicted mm-hmm. accurately, but the aesthetic component is pretty different. So like what is futurism today?
What is the futurism of today? I think it's kind of impossible to imagine what the futurism of today is because we don't really have a conception, you know, sort of going to like the whole Mark Fisher idea of like canceled futures. We don't really have like a cohesive vision of what the future is. I mean, we have like eternal kind of like visions of like, oh, like Mars and moon colonies and stuff like that. But as a culture, as a society, we don't really have like a cohesive overarching vision of what our future is, and so we don't really have futurism. We sort of have like, I guess this is what retrofuturism is. It's sort of like a cannibalizing of the aesthetics of the past and sort of like some makeshift kind of future.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you saw that with all these different kind of revivals. So like in the 80s, there was like an Art Deco revival. You saw that in illustrations, but also mm-hmm. also in architecture. Like that's a subgenre niche that really should have taken off.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there was a book. You posted images. It was from this interior garden aesthetics in the book Living Under the Glass, Sunrooms, Greenhouses, and Conservatories. So that was from the 80s, but it was nostalgia for the like Victorian era aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah, that sort of like that sense of a kind of like closer communion with nature, but still sort of like, you know, if you think about it, like sort of thinking of the glass as a kind of screen that we sort of use to interface with nature, and that is the kind of futuristic element of it.
Eco or tropical brutalism is another one. I'm not sure how common it is in actual architecture, but it's popular. It's popular online, but I'm not sure how common it is. But that one's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting with like the sort of tropical brutalism thing because it is kind of a it's like a manifestation of this like what is it called? It's like a landscape painting style called Capriccio, Capriccio, where they sort of envision like the ruins of spaces. So instead of building like a huge, like, or instead of painting like a cathedral, they'll paint like a cathedral in ruins. And one of the big artists of that was Hubert Robert, who was almost like a post-apocalyptic sci-fi kind of painter, because all of his works, and he worked in like the 1700s and the early 1800s, but all of his work sort of depicted a Europe in ruins and like the people sort of frolicking among these future ruins. And I think that is sort of part of the appeal of tropical brutalism, because brutalism for a time was considered like the cutting edge architectural style.
Yeah, it's sometimes viewed as more austere. But, like, yeah. The brutalism can be glitzier. Well, yeah, like, the John C. Portman designed Embarcadero Center in San Francisco, that's kind of the glitzier brutalism, but has elements of like the eco brutalism and like kind of lush gardens. You're familiar with that structure.
Here, let me Google it. What is it?
Yeah, Embarcadero Center in San Francisco. And then the other one, also Google the Rodeo Collection in Beverly Hills. That one, that one too. I wouldn't call Rodeo Collection brutalism, but it's archaeo-futurist. It's futuristic, but it has the feeling of like wandering through like a lost ancient city.
Oh yeah, 100%. And like you also see it a lot in like Brasilia, where they basically try to make an entire, you know, in Brazil, obviously, they try to do like a planned city, and so they had all these like futuristic kind of buildings.
Oh, but Brasilia is more. I would say I would think of that as more as like mid-century space age, but it's also it's very spread out. Like you have these kind of wide, like what very like very wide like highway like boulevards.
Yeah, and so it's less brutalism, but it's still this sort of like conception. Like there's a quote by Robert Hughes, who he was like an art critic from Australia, and he died like 10 years ago at this point. He said like nothing dates faster than like our conceptions of the future. And so you have like all of these like sort of futuristic architectural spaces, but then when you look at them now, they look like the ruins of like some civilization that died.
With the kind of concept of like an arcology or self-contained cities, it's futuristic, but it also has connections to like ancient cities and how people used to live. But even you going to these different places that have like lots of atriums or lots of arcades, courtyards, as opposed to kind of like the banal of just a street, how kind of urban design zoning works is like there just lacks any kind of imagination. Like you have one street with one-story stores on the side, and then it's residential.
Yeah.
Yeah, like theme park urbanism, too. The whimsical qualities of urbanism that you only really see in theme parks or, like, in a Vegas casino.
Yeah, and Disney, like, that makes me automatically think of Disneyland. And Disneyland is fascinating because at least when it was, like, originally constructed, there was, like, this huge fascination and nostalgia with like the 1890s, and so that kind of goes back to like what you were saying about like the like incorporating the old like Victorian aesthetic of shopping arcades into modern styles. You had that sort of I'm sure it's all remodeled now, but like in the original vision of Disneyland,
a lot of Disneyland has been remodeled, but I think Main Street USA has been that's pretty much intact, but pretty much the same. Matt and I discussed this on our show we did about Lynch and about Twin Peaks, is it sort of these theme parks capture the essence of like a idealized version of a small town, but it's much more condensed and compact. And a lot of people will ridicule that as inauthentic. But you go, you just go even places that are historic, like there is just something kind of missing just because of the layout that you wouldn't get in a theme park.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you have any other thoughts on like the design of Disneyland?
Nothing. Not much, really. I mean, I think of, thinking about it, I've just mainly been interested in that kind of 1950s, because what I'm really interested in lately is like what were people nostalgic about during the times that we're nostalgic now. And I mean the rule is always 30 years, you know, where everybody's has nostalgia for 20 or 30 years. I think to go back and read like what it was that people were like fascinated by. So like you had in like the 60s and 70s like this, you had like a double nostalgia for like Prohibition era. So you had Bonnie and Clyde and
Or what? Even yeah, westerns. That maybe that was more the 50s to early 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you also had like in terms of like the sort of 60s like counterculture, like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, like a fascination with like the style of like I don't know what it would be like old like Rococo Baroque troubadour style of dress. And so thinking about Disneyland, you have that nostalgia for like the Victorian era and thinking about that in the context of like the movies that came out in the 50s from Disney. Like you had like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which was a kind of like retro futurism.
So what happened with Disneyland is they were going to remodel. So Tomorrowland was originally Tomorrowland was like a mid-century modern space age aesthetic from when, yeah. when it was completed in the 50s. From there, what happened is there was a plan to redevelop it into something like a, into that kind of more kind of steampunk aesthetic from like the Victorian era sci-fi. But what happened is it wasn't fully implemented. And I think now, if you go to Tomorrowland today, it's just a big kind of hodgepodge of different genres, and it's not... It wasn't fully implemented, so it didn't come out so great.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of neon signage, animated, and thoughts on, like, the preservation issues, and a little bit of kind of the revival in interest in the past few decades?
I am a fan. I am all in favor of preserving and restoring any sort of vintage signage, whether it's neon or otherwise. I do think there is sort of a division, aesthetically speaking, between people who prefer the sort of like neon vision of the 80s versus people who prefer the pastel vision of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely on like the pastel side. But, I mean, I love any neon sign, and if it's, you know, if it's been there for, like, decades, I think it should be preserved, absolutely.
Well, I think one of them is, like, the kind of cyberpunk neon image from the 80s, that was more of a conceptual vision of the future, rather than, yeah. Well, it's different in Japan, of course, but it wasn't really implemented in the 80s on a large scale in the U.S., But the thing is the pastel vision, like brick glasses, that's capturing like the interior of the era. That was more realistic.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point, Robert. I think that a lot of the association with 80s and neon had to do with an aspirational aesthetic that, as you said, was only very sparingly actually implemented here, maybe more so in Japan and other places. As the pastel vision, that strikes me as much like the type of stuff that you see in a movie, like just to pull one out randomly, like Pretty in Pink. Talking about that, you know, that's probably what the 80s really looked like, more so than you know, like an FM Attack video.
Yeah, exactly.
Like neon, really, the peak was more like 30s, like the 30s to the 60s, and then like there wasn't like a mass like implementation in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it's more. It's actually probably more, as you said, 50s, 60s. It's mid-century modernism more so than it is something specifically 80s.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, looking at these kind of trends in art and kind of how like a lot of trad types really like to bash modern art, and the focus is like what is considered fine art. So the post-war era, there was a shift towards. Abstract expressionism, and so you tend to post a lot of the art is more like illustrations, and a lot of these illustrations are very, very much more maximalistic, and mm-hmm. influenced from like past genres from Art Nouveau, Art Deco, Surrealism. I think one of the ones that comes to mind is illustrator and artist Jim Buckles. And he was mostly Nagel. Patrick Nagel did a lot of the illustrations from the 80s, kind of Art Deco influence, like the Duran Duran color. But he's a bit more, he's like super famous. And it used to be like he would be at every, you'd see a Nagel at every nail salon in LA. But the thing is, like, yeah, Jim Buckles does these kind of, these surreal architectural landscape images.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It's very, it almost reminds me, in a weird way, it's like a fusion of, like, old or, like, Art Nouveau kind of, like, 80s thing, but also it has a bit of, like, a Lisa Frank and, like, Thomas Kincaid kind of vibe.
Very surreal,
yeah.
Otherworldly. I think the other artist that you've posted is the illustrations of these, like, surreal, kind of Victorian-inspired dollhouses, Daniel Merriam.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
Yeah, I think I said, like, someone needs to make, like, a Vegas casino based on off of Merriam's work.
That'd be awesome. I'd go there.
Or, yeah, even just, like, a hotel.
Hell yeah.
I'm not sure if they're more Victorian or Baroque, but kind of a lot of these artists, like, it's fusionism, like, they borrow from the best of these different past genres, and then they push it more futuristic, more grandiose. So, there is so much. If you're, like, an illustrator, there's no limits on creativity, which is, obviously, there's going to be a lot of barriers with an actual building project.
Yeah, for sure.
Are you also a fan of sci-fi illustration?
Yeah, I do like some. I'm trying to think of who... I like Virgil Findlay, who he's more sort of like 30s and 40s, like pulp kind of stuff. Maybe 50s too. I like... And he's actually been called... He's like the William Blake of pulp, which I think is really cool. Title. I like Bruce Pennington. I like one who I think is Paul Ladd, maybe that's his name. I also like of course the classic, like, I think he's a Polish, he was a Polish guy, like Bakinski. And he did super, like, surreal, like, sci-fi horror, like, landscapes and stuff like that, and he's great.
Yeah, so kind of looking at the politics of art, it's interesting as about a decade ago is I would identify more with, like, Swipple, with more kind of Swipple interests rather than rightist on aesthetics. Mm-hmm. But I think it was different, like, what was being embraced, like, a decade ago and even, like, some aspects of the hipster culture then, and, like, what is considered... Like, what is the kind of aesthetic of, like, mainstream liberalism today? Woke capital, like, this neoliberal realism is another genre of a lot of, like, the kind of pro-Biden portraits and artwork. Mm. And you kind of see how a lot of, like, dissidents have sort of adopted retrofuturism, like, the symbolism of what the genre says about the past we could have had. But to what degree do you think there is, like, political symbolism in aesthetics?
Oh, I think there's a ton of political symbolism in aesthetics. I think style, to quote Martin Amis, and he was referring to literary style, but I think it applies to aesthetic, visual style, and everything. Style is not neutral. It gives moral direction. And so there is always going to be a kind of implicit political understanding to any aesthetic, you know, point of view, because part of the word aesthetic is ethic. And I think it's absolutely integral. I think what you have is a kind of, among the sort of neoliberal or, like, I guess woke kind of left-wing crowd, like, I hesitate to even use the word left-wing because they're more or less just sort of, like, corporatist kind of neoliberal kind of thing, they have no real, like, if you ask them what is, like, what are their aesthetic sort of, like, priors, or what do they like aesthetically, I don't think you could talk to, like, a host of Chapo Trap House and, like, have a conversation about aesthetics.
Things have become so fragmented into these, yeah, different kind of online subcultures, and I think with generations, I think with millennials, there was at least there was like the hipster culture, but with Zoomers, I'm noticing the trend is people are joining up in these kind of online tribes. So there's no like one. There's a kind of banal, like minimalistic aesthetic of what would be considered mainstream, and then individuals are just kind of drifting off into their own subculture. But there's no really dominant strain in aesthetics. And I'd even say with architecture, probably because the internet is there is a cliche of the minimalism of the 2010s, but I'm actually seeing, like, going on different architectural sites and blogs, one trend I've noticed is there's such a diversity and variety in proposals. There's no, like, unified aesthetic of this genre that would be, like, stereotypical in the way these different 20th century genres were, like the 80s.
Yeah, I think you're right, Robert. I think that there is a prevailing, the word that was used earlier was corporatist, and I think that's really the only
The
prevailing kind of corporatist aesthetics and worldview that comes the closest to being something that's more or less uniform across society. Outside of that, you have a very packed periphery of different ideas and different aesthetics that I think are kind of jockeying for influence right now, and in many ways are confined to the internet.
Do you think that creative types are drifting away from the sort of mainstream, I mean, not becoming right-wing, but drifting away from the mainstream kind of, like, woke corporatist center? Because a lot of it depends, like, where artists align politically has been based historically on patronage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
I'll just comment really quickly. I think that the kind of rightward side of the aisle has really led the way in terms of having these kind of counterculture, if you want to call them countercultural aesthetics, with the, you know, the memes of it all in 2016 and whatnot. And I think that largely a lot of other sort of more dissident communities on the left or wherever they might align themselves have kind of rode those coattails to a large extent. I'm not sure that fully answers the question you asked, but I think that a lot of interesting sort of counter-corporatist or counter-cultural aesthetics were, and this is a real contribution that, you know, the contemporary right and the internet, the very online right has made, was to kind of hit on that stuff first. And you see, we were talking about, like, Chapo earlier, like, I think a lot of the aesthetics that people, you know, that Chapo Trap House and a lot of those left-wing communities have tried to have are basically just, like, trying to copy that.
Yeah, absolutely.
With the symbolism of aesthetics, like, the... Yeah, definitely aesthetic symbolism in film. Like, there's a few... There's, like, a few different, like, YouTubers who will actually analyze films. Yeah, even Jay Dyer sort of does that, like, try to figure out, like, the symbolism of everything. But I generally... film, but also same with literature, or plays even, like, I have a preference for films that focus on aesthetics in the sense of play. So, like a film where they're constantly exploring new physical locations, like, I've actually watched, like, plays or films where everything takes place in one location. I mean, that does kind of bore me. So, yeah, I have a pretty strong preference for films that focus on the sense of place.
Yeah, and that's what I love about two directors, Argento and Greenaway. You know, Argento, of course, he did Suspiria, which is all about, like, sort of, like, the geometry and geography of place and how places themselves can be haunted and evil and cause death. And then Greenaway, I mean, most of that, the Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, is set in that one restaurant, but, like, he films it uniquely at each sort of vignette, and, like, it becomes, like, this labyrinthine space that you really feel, like, by the end of it, that you've inhabited.
Yeah, also, like, surrealism in film, and, yeah, it does seem, like, why is that unique to the 80s? Like, is it just, like, the popularity or cultural influences as far as surreal qualities, like, in kind of horror or fantasy films, or is it the right balance in technology and kind of looking at the trends that became before and after. So before the 80s, there was more restrictions about like what could be portrayed in Hollywood. And then after that, there's obviously trends which had bad results for creativity, but like the kind of unique cinema photographic effect in the 80s to early 90s film, like the Miracle Mile director, Steve DeJarnett, I had on, he went into some of the details about the types of lighting and like fog. I think using like artificial fog is a bit cliche, but that adds to it. Yeah, like, what are your thoughts on those kind of, like, surreal qualities in films, and can you think of some films you can mention?
Well, the movie that immediately comes to mind, and one that I guess watched recently, like, over Christmas, is a French movie called, the title that I know it as is called Deadly Games, and it's, like, about this kid who's, like, a wannabe Rambo in, like, his huge, like, castle-like mansion that he lives with his, like, you know, businesswoman mom and this, like, basically invalid grandpa. And then, you know, through a series of events, I won't bog down with the plot. Basically, he gets stalked. He and his grandpa get stalked throughout the house by, like, this deranged department store Santa. It's a great movie. And, like, there's, like, it's so fascinating because, like, the house is, like, full of, like, booby traps and full of these rooms and full of that kind of, like, soft-focus, blue-tinted fog machine. Like,
oh, yeah,
aesthetic.
The fog machine, yeah.
Yeah. I'm checking out pictures now. Yeah, I know the aesthetic you're talking about.
Yeah, it's like this weird, you know, going back to Fisher-Price, it's like this weird, like, Fisher-Price gothic kind of aesthetic that you saw a lot in movies of that time. Like, I think Child's Play had it, and you kind
of saw it
in Big, and like Richie Rich, and kind of stuff like that, where like the excess is almost displayed in like not like a, in like an almost like nauseating way, because like it's so like brightly colored, kind of.
It adds so much to the nightmarish quality of the movie.
Or they'll show, like, a kind of, a like, film noir-inspired, where it's a dark street, the fog machine, and then, like, a neon sign behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I don't know if it's just because I watched those kinds of movies as a kid, but for me, it's, like, that's what I remember nightmares being like as a kid, is, like, almost having that aesthetic, you know, very, like, lurid. Like, it's pretty on one level, but it's almost, you know, it's almost lurid.
Yeah, like, the special effects is, like, prior to the 80s, the special effects were maybe more primitive, but I think, like, even with a lot of newer horror films, the special effects are too, they're so digitalized, or they're more advanced, but it kind of ruins that hypnagogic or dreamlike or nightmare-like quality.
100%.
Absolutely. And, like, and other examples of that are, like, kind of, like, stuff like Babes in Toyland, or like a big one was, and this is from the 50s actually, was, and I remember watching, seeing it with like my mom at like some revival theater, like when I was a little kid, 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. Like, it's all of that, like, kind of, and I guess Wizard of Oz would be another great example. It's like all this like weird dreamlike hypnagogic, everything that you see on screen has been handmade one way or another. And that sort of just, like, enhances the kind of, like, otherworldly, like, nightmarish quality.
Yeah, no, definitely.
You do post on Twitter these, like, 80s interiors from different films. I'm not sure if they're, like, documented, but can you think of any different 80s films that the interiors really stand out?
Yeah, here, let me think. 80s movies, interiors. I mean, a classic one, of course, is Scarface. I mean,
you know what is
Scarface, and also
one of those new retro wave labels. I think it was Summer 1984. They did a video using imagery from Scarface, and that image of the, I did a painting of this actually inspired by that. But they go into a nightclub, and it's like Roman, it's like Greco-Roman, but all like pink and turquoise neon.
Yeah, So that one's a classic one. And, of course, that is, like, him in his bathroom, that is a total Bathist gang aesthetic right there. Other ones, I think I haven't actually seen it, but, like, I've, like, posted stills from it just because, like, I've seen it on Instagram as, like, Year of the Dragon. Yeah, Michael Cimino. And what else? Those are the only ones that are coming to mind right now. I mostly watched a lot of horror movies from the 80s, actually.
We were going to discuss Jacob's Ladder, and I just rewatched that last night.
What'd you think of it?
Yeah, just as far as surrealism goes, could kind of make the comparison like it's like a Hellraiser film, but with a white pill at the end.
Oh, for sure. Well, it's interesting because it's like part of what is so terrifying about it is that it's like the geography of New York City. It becomes this like dungeon-like
Yeah, that's what I like about the film is the geography aspects, the labyrinth of that, because also the sense of mystery, because I think a lot of like horror films that reveal too much that ruins it, because like I saw some horror film recently, the one about like this evil marionette puppet, and it's pretty I'd say fairly mediocre, but they reveal the storyline pretty early on, but the sense of mystery. But the main thing that's great about Jacob's Ladder, I think, like the beginning, the opening scene in the subway where he gets stranded, and then also the scene later on in the hospital, like how the architecture, geographic labyrinth of it is like what sets the horror.
Yeah, and it's interesting how it's like all of like the locales of the horror and of the surrealism are like public services kind of places, like the hospital and like the subway system that, you know, everybody in New York City has been on the subway some point in their lives. And so it's like everybody is familiar with that like uneasy feel, you know, and even here in Portland, we don't have a subway system, but we have, you know, some kind, we have public transport.
But what it does kind of reminds me of is, like most of the times I've been on a subway, it's been pretty crowded. But when I went to school in LA, like there used to be all these like kind of creepy underground tunnels that go over under the street, and something the labyrinth, tunnels could be, there's symbolism for his journey through the afterlife.
Yeah, I guess the sense that there's like some subterranean other that can be happening at any moment in those tunnels. And you're saying it's like a white pill at the end, but actually I think it's an even blacker pill, because so he goes through this journey of, you know, as they say, you know, Meister Eckhart, it's like the torment of hell is because, you know, you're unable to let go. And so he finally let goes and dies, and it goes to, you know, the white light or whatever. But at the end of the day, regardless of all the things that happened throughout the movie being just like a vision, he was still the subject of some like military, like chemical warfare experiment. And so essentially it's like this idea that, the horrors of the bulk of the movie weren't real, but like at the end of the film, he was like, you know, thinking about like the quote, history from James Joyce, history is a nightmare from which I'm unable to awake. He is still subject to like the traumas and like the torture of historical processes.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It is. What is a kind of example of a film that's successful at being creepy, but without a lot of overt violence.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm thinking as there's a film, Hellraiser Inferno, I think it's the fifth one, and it's similar to Jacob's Ladder, but with a dark ending.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I haven't actually seen it, but I've talked to you about it, and like I sort of like read about the plot, and that one sounds pretty intense.
The film, Southbound is, that film has similar themes, like the town in the desert, which is kind of, it represents purgatory, but the people, But it's not, there's actually no implication that they've died. It's more that they get stranded there, like they leave a lot. There's a lot of mystery to that. They don't expose like all the secrets to Southbound. And then I recently saw an 80s horror film, The Serpent in the Rainbow.
That's a great one.
Oh yeah.
Is that another one that involves, I haven't seen that either, but is that another one that involves afterlife as a theme?
It's like zombie voodoo stuff.
Oh yeah, I like that stuff, especially combined with an 80s aesthetic, so it's probably worth checking out.
Hell yeah. And then I think Wes Craven did it too.
Oh so. Yeah.
Yeah, Kino, as they say.
You're a Lynch fan? Do you have a favorite David Lynch films, and how would you describe the Lynchian aesthetic?
Man, let's see, what are my favorite? My favorite is probably Blue Velvet.
Mm-hmm.
Mulholland Drive hit me like a fucking freight train. That movie is just intensely depressing. I mean, I loved every second of it, but that was a wild ride. But yeah, definitely Blue Velvet is my favorite. The Lynchian aesthetic, it's a sort of uncanniness, and like everything is like sort of moving through just like a liminal space, I guess.
Oh yeah, also Lynch likes to fuse genres, so in Twin Peaks you have everything from, it's unclear because I think it's sort of implied that it takes place in the present, but there's like a fusion of different past genres, so you have like 80s but with 50s nostalgia or the Old West.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, a bit of Old West, and definitely with Twin Peaks in particular, an homage to soap opera as a genre.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that sort of Peyton Place kind of.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see, like, hypothetically, if David Lynch directed Jacob's Ladder.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if it would. I actually haven't seen Jacob's Ladder, which I plan to soon, so I can't comment that much, but I wonder if that would almost be too on the nose for Lynch, given the theme that overtly in, what, Afterlife? I don't know the movie too well, but whereas with David Lynch, it's weird. It's a weird take on the normal. Like, that's for me is a big part of the Lynchian aesthetic, I guess, where it never, overtly names, like, oh, this is a psychological problem someone is having, some fantastic, well, I guess there are more overt fantastical elements, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I almost wonder if with David Lynch, it's kind of like something like Jacob's Ladder, but as applied to the most day-to-day kind of white picket fence scenario.
Yeah, it's like you, I think, hit it on the head. It's sort of, it's like his whole aesthetic is like taking what is normal and just sort of like putting it, in like uncanny lighting, not like literal lighting, but just like having a sort of like weird sort of ness to it. Like, are you guys familiar with the photographer Gregory Crudson?
Let me look him up.
Oh, yeah, let me look
Gregory Crudson?
Yeah, Crudson, C-R-E-W-D, Sun.
Oh, yeah, like abandoned small towns?
Yeah, he like has this, he like reminds me a lot of Lynch in terms of like weird, like, suburban gothic, like, tableaus that, like, seem somewhat normal, but as you look closer, like, you sort of, like with the beginning of Blue Velvet, you notice, like, the black bugs teeming deep in the grass kind of thing.
Well, it's a bit like that with Jacob's Ladder, because, like, the opening scene with the subway, it does reveal something's wrong, but the initial assumption is that he's just having hallucinations from the war, PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't find out, like, these different layers of revealing secrets, and the different filmmakers and writers, like, deciding the process of when to reveal. Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of films reveal too much too soon. Like, I watched the Silent Hill horror films, which were inspired by the... I've never played the video games, but the second one was definitely reminded me of Jacob's Ladder, but the first one felt more of a generic horror film.
Interesting. I never played those games, so.
No, I haven't played, them either.
Style, but.
Yeah. Do you mean, Robert, do you mean, I haven't seen them either, but this is the first one fall victim to over-explaining?
Yeah. The second one, because I watched the second one first, but the second one totally reminds me of Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, because another movie, I think Blargeist, you said you'd seen this too, Southbound. I think one of the things that makes that movie so good, despite appearing to be like a kind of low budget or, you know, medium to low budget horror movie, is it so very much doesn't explain it so very much doesn't over explain that I remain interested in that movie, and I've seen it a few times now. I think when you're creating that kind of intense psychological state, as David Lynch's films do as well, I think the key is to not over explain them.
Yeah, exactly. Explanation is the death of surrealism or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's surrealism rather than just generic horror. But I don't know if, Robert, you have another item to go to. Geeks for a second. I do. Your profile image is Dr. Jacoby from Twin Peaks.
Oh, yeah,
I don't know if
you've
talked about this elsewhere, but what is the kind of kinship you feel with that character? Or is kinship the wrong word? I'm just curious.
Well, he's I just think he's fascinating. He's a quirky guy, of course. And I like his sort of, yeah, I don't know. I didn't really think about it that much when I made my PFP him. But, like, it definitely, I feel like he has, like, this sort of, like, weird, just, like, I'm just hanging out quality. And
yeah,
that's what I connect to. Yeah.
Gotcha.
He's a very sort of like Terrence McKenna kind of figure.
Oh yeah. I feel like there might be some kind of Lynch McKenna. Maybe not. I mean, definitely he was Lynch. It opens Terrence McKenna fan or anything like that. But I mean, you know, he's into transcendental meditation, all these things. That you gotta wonder if maybe he was based off of McKenna or Leary or these folks, and how much that influenced David Lynch.
You're also a Curb Your Enthusiasm fan, but one thing I've noticed is, like, as I'm getting older, I'm pretty picky about like comedy. Like a decade ago, or when I was younger, like I could watch all kinds of like binge watch like crappy comedy films, and at this point, like as far as comedy, like I can watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, or I can only watch like a comedy if it's like a dark comedy. But most comedy sucks.
Yeah,
I don't really watch comedies that much. Actually,
no, neither
like,
do I.
I really only watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Veep is pretty good. But yeah, other than that, like my main sort of media diet, movie wise, is like sort of horror or action or like just like general like grindhouse like exploitation shit from like the like 70s and 80s. But I love Curb. Curb is probably my favorite series.
Do you have a favorite episode?
Probably the Black Swan episode.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's a black swan on the golf course.
Oh, yeah, and it ends up getting killed or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. I guess, like, that one is, like, the perfect, like, example of how, like, all of, like, the threads come together in just, like, a classic Curb way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that one.
Also, the one with where he goes to this house... of some Hollywood associate, and he decapitates the doll there. That was my favorite one.
Yeah,
that's a great one.
And then and then he has to get the doll from another collection, I think.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Larry David's liberal himself, but he does poke fun at woke culture, or he does call out like a lot of societal taboos.
Oh, for sure. I mean, he's just. Anyone that curmudgeonly is not going to fall victim to the whole woke sort of culture thing. So even if he is like a liberal, he's in like a liberal in like a kind of like old fashioned way, you know?
Yeah. He does seem to be that. I mean, he endorsed Biden very wholeheartedly.
Oh, yeah. Like the new season, there was the most recent season they did it. There was an episode like poking fun at Me Too culture where Larry gets Me Too'd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This last season especially, I thought there was a lot of fair and good, not not too far in any one direction, but, you know, poking fun at that kind of woke stuff. And there's also that classic MAGA hat gimmick.
Oh, yeah, funny.
And I'm definitely not pro-Trump, but I actually think Trump, am I mistaken? I think Trump, when he had a Twitter, rest in peace, didn't Trump retweet?
Yeah, he retweeted, like, a video from it.
Yeah, because, like, it's not pro-Trump, but it's not exactly, I mean, make no mistake, Larry David is anti-Trump, but the skit itself, it's not exactly anti-Trump, it's more just, you know, playing out what that would look like to wear a MAGA hat in LA and how it could give you a certain,
Yeah, or just making fun, kind of making fun of, like, the crowd he's in, like, the kinds of people who take themselves very seriously.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm an LA native, so I think it is an accurate portrayal of a certain kind of subset of LA.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I'm not an LA native, but I've been here long enough now that, yeah, very one of the most real. I like the fantastical version of LA that you get in a lot of things, the very aesthetic version, like in Mulholland Drive. But in terms of, like, the realism of what the people in LA are like.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. Even California, like, I did a show a while back.
On Californication, yeah.
And even that, like, that just seems, it's entertaining, but it just seems like almost like a stereotype of Hollywood. A lot of it doesn't seem that accurate. Wasn't Californication, also like the Zero Zeros, it was much more hypersexualized prior to the, like, 2010s, yeah, neo-Puritanism. I
mean, this is, not to go on a tangent here, I don't know if this is on the, you know, planned menu for this episode, but, like, you know, being around, I've only been around Hollywood people since, like, 2017, so it's basically all post-Me Too, and it looks a lot more like the, you know, very self-serious liberalism as lampooned on Curb. The reality of the world portrayed in Californication, I can't comment on. I assume it was a bit real at some point. I mean, Luke Ford, who you've had on this show, has talked about how hypersexual it used to feel in Hollywood, but that is not, that's definitely not something that you get anymore.
Hmm.
Also, his choice of locations, like Larry does, on Curb Enthusiasm, he focuses on the banal, even though it's, I mean, places that are, locations that are very upscale, he doesn't, like, show any of LA's landmarks, like, he portrays it as a local wood.
Yeah, you see a lot of strip malls and stuff like that, and I'll dox myself here, not really, but I live in the San Fernando Valley, and then in the last season, the coffee shop in Curb Your Enthusiasm, I get autistic about this kind of stuff, so I was pretty excited to find that it was just a few blocks from my house on Ventura Boulevard where they filmed that. And yeah, it's just like this strip mall with an IHOP. But yeah.
Mocha Joe's is.
Yeah, we're Mocha Joe's, that's right. Yep, I live. Robert, next time you're down in LA, we should go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're at the end of the show, Blauergeist. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Or do you want to plug any website you have, social media presence, or do you have any upcoming projects you're working on?
Yeah, I'm doing an ongoing podcast with a couple buddies. We're called the Elroy Boys. We're doing, it's a sort of regular ongoing conversation related to the author James Elroy, so he's a LA native. And we had our most recent sort of independent episode come out about Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. That's in my pinned tweet. I recommend everybody check that out. And also, I am in the process of starting a web magazine called Apocalypse Confidential. I don't have, like, a site or account ready for that yet, but I hope to have that sort of all set up and launched middle of February.
And you're from Portland. Do you have anything, like, to add about the urbanism there, the culture, and also, like, the more recent, like, talk of the city in decay with the unrest last year?
Yeah, Portland has always, and I'm sure every city is like this, but in my experience, Portland is a city that's always going through a decay and development cycle. And that cycle has been ramped up after sort of the unrest in recent months. Like, I went downtown recently, and I never felt unsafe, but, like, it definitely felt hollowed out in a way that I had never experienced before. And it was sort of, it felt like 5 years of decay had happened in, you know, the span of 5 months. And what that just means is that once everything settles down, there's going to be sort of like hyper development.
Like these cycles of urban renewal. So you see that happening more as opposed to like a permanent, not a permanent, like you see that happening rather than like a decade long decay in like most urban centers.
Yeah. Sense. Like there's a lot of spaces that are boarded up and it just felt like weirdly empty. Like, I mean, there were people walking around, but like,
I have no idea if there's like, I'm not going to speculate too much if there's about whether there's like a deliberate conspiracy, but yeah, like all these places that were destroyed by rioting, like unless we see like a huge crime surge, like I don't see them just sitting there. I think in the next several years, I think they'll be redeveloped and developers will be able to pick up that property probably cheaper.
Yeah, for sure.
Blauergeist, it's been a great show. Great talk. Thanks for being on, and thanks, Matt, too.
Yeah, sure thing.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, great to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.